Okay, let's just open up with an offering of the incense, the fruit of our lips, offering gratitude in this moment for all those beings throughout space and time who devoted themselves to cultivation and awakening. Incense burning, all space is filled with the fragrance. All Buddhas smell it from afar. Auspicious clouds gather everywhere. With utmost sincerity, all Buddhas appear. We pay homage and offer clouds of incense to the Bodhisattvas and the Mahasattvas. We pay homage, we offer clouds of incense to the Bodhisattvas and the Mahasattvas. We pay homage, we offer clouds of incense to the Bodhisattvas and the Mahasattvas. There's a saying that you're known by the company that you keep. And when we give that offering of praise to the people who have cultivated and dedicated themselves, Buddha didn't say that this is my Dharma. He said, I rediscovered the path. So that meant that the path has existed, throughout time, and he happened to have discovered it. And he said, come, let me show you, let me tell you, let me point you in the direction that you can discover this for yourself. So it's not what anyone gets for him, for others, but one gets for himself. So if we keep that in mind when we're learning from the Buddha, we will realize what our part is in this, and we'll take up a live action, a life of walking the path, rather than it being so much an academic exercise or an intellectual exercise. And it helps us to establish within our own hearts and within our own mind, the purpose of life. As a Christian, I used to always be like wondering, like, what is my purpose? What is my purpose? And always just searching out and seeking out, what am I here to do? What am I supposed to do? But that was before I understood causality, cause and condition. So now I recognize, like, there is no perfect purpose. I'm here due to causes and conditions. So now I just decide, what shall I do with myself since I'm here? And that has changed then for me, my whole way of approaching spiritual life and how to seize the essence or make use of my presence while I'm here. And he said some people don't believe that there's anything after this. So if they believe that way, then fine, they will be able to have a fortunate life here in spite of all the vicissitudes. He said some people believe. He said those of a little learning. The first was those of no learning, like just enjoy life because tomorrow you die. And then he said those of little learning will aspire for there to be a reappearance in a heavenly realm. And he said, and then those of great learning will even bypass the heavenly appearance and go for the ultimate realm of neither birth nor death. Now, when we start talking about that, that's something we like. I mean, you can't explain enlightenment to an unenlightened person no way to do. And I'm assuming that most of us on this call, including myself, are unenlightened. So we have to leave some things as an aspiration. But here's the thing about having an aspiration. It leads you, there's a trajectory. It leads you in a direction in which to go. And that's how I'd like to close out our retreat time together today with a trajectory. I believe I'm correct on this. The very last in-person retreat I gave at Sims was was the Dharma of cultivation. What is cultivation? And we spent those 3 days, Friday evening, Saturday, and Sunday, really reviewing and discussing the Dharma of cultivation. And I think Tiwari had ordered the book. So some of you may have been in that retreat. Some of you may have enjoyed that retreat. And then the book I put on the shelf with everything else. But this is not like a book that we read. It's a manual for traveling the path. It's a manual for taking the journey. It's a roadmap. It helps you to know where you are. You are here, you know. Helps us to understand if we've, you know, vectored off and need to make a U-turn and go back to the last exit and get back on the path. Or maybe we turn the wrong way coming out the driveway completely and have to go all the way back to point A and start over again. You know, and, you know, that's not such a bad thing when we have to recalibrate something. We have to reset something. We have to go back. We think in our unawakened human terms that's always a regression, but sometimes we have to retreat to advance, you know, so we shouldn't hold concepts so tightly and then let it color everything that we do. A lot of this is the freedom to shift, the freedom to change, the freedom to go back and repair, the freedom to make something better, the freedom to do something different. But we get so locked into things, so concretized, you know, around our concept, our views, the things we've done, the things we know, that it inhibits our capacity for full release. And so what I'm hoping that I inspire in you during this retreat is just to be more open and more receptive, question everything, challenging your assumptions, not for the sake of other people or for the sake of appearing a certain way for other people, but for the sake of finding one's own true inner freedom. And then you won't matter. It won't matter to you so much if people agree with you or disagree. It's just that you are at peace with your own self in your own heart. It's almost like looking through rose-colored glasses, except for if rose represents what is true, then it's looking through rose-colored glasses. So I have to tell you, I'm confessing, Marilyn. So Marilyn just called me. She said, "Hey, are you getting on?" I said, "Yeah, of course I'd be on today." She said, "Well, we've been sitting in meditation waiting for you." I said, "What?" I said, "What time is it?" She said, "It's whatever your time is, 8:15. It's 11:15 here." But I started preparing myself about 3 hours ago. Those 3 hours went like 15 minutes for me. Now, some of this is because this is my job and you should do what you love doing. Okay, so this is my job and I really love it. But what it points to that it's bigger than that for me is that when you're doing what you love, the concept of time completely goes out the window. The concept of time is only like right there when you're doing things that you're like marginally okay with. Like what time is it now? You know, because there is this eye on what you're doing and also this other world out here. But when you are engrossed, enmeshed in what you love doing, I mean, It's timeless. That's why you can get to a place that you sit in meditation and think you sat for 15 minutes and you get up and 2 hours pass. 2 hours pass. You know, and a lot of times during the, I start my meditations in the nighttime, you know, like around 3 in the morning. That's because human beings are asleep. And so their mental energy is not running all over the place. So it makes it for easier practice because the mental atmosphere, you know, is more spacious at that time. Now, and the Buddha said that's why it's a good time to get up and start by then, because then by the time human beings start moving around, like you're already in a zone, you're already in a groove, and they can't even bother you. But they can inhibit you when you're starting at a time. I mean, people who have stronger minds than us, there are many people, you know, they may be not, minds may not be focused around Dharma, but they certainly are concentrated and well-established and developed in their thought world, and their minds can be stronger than ours. So if their minds are stronger than ours, they can influence us. It's like when you plan to go to a peace rally and you take, you know, peace is the answer and love is the way signs, you know, and then somebody comes and pushes you and you turn around and you start beating them over the head with the sign, you know, because of the energies of the people that are present there. You never meant to go there and like be violent yourself, you know, but overcome by the abundance of the energy of others. And that's one reason why I honestly like meditating alone. I have enough of my own negativities that I need to address. Now I don't want to have to deal with mine. I got to deal with yours. You'll even be sitting in a group with people that you don't like, or people that don't like you. And so you're just complicating, creating more stuff that people have to work with. But we come together here because there are not that many opportunities for us to know like-minded people. Unless those of you who want to be like me, I mean, then you can welcome to join me. We set up communities and we live together in communities. But most of us would rather live alone or rather live out in the world and do the things that they want to do. Nobody's telling them when, you know, we're not agreeing, we're all going to get up at this time and we're going to do these things. It's like, I want to do what I want to do. And that's perfectly okay. But just look at what it is that you want to do, you know, and really look at it and see that however you're living, it is just how you have decided that you want to do. There's nobody holding a gun to your head or a knife to your neck. You have decided you want to live in this world. Own it, as the Buddha says. You know, don't put it on somebody else. Own it. And if there's something in your life that you're not happy with, change it, the Buddha said. And all of his teaching is designed to give you the courage that you can make the changes that you really desire to make. Sometimes we honestly feel or believe that we have no way out, no other way. But with every temptation, there is a way of escape. But we have to find it. We want somebody to come and give it to us, give us the answer. Okay, somebody gives you the answer, like, no, I don't want to do that. Or I don't want to follow that. Or I can't do that. Yeah. Sometimes you have a dilemma and you don't know what to do. And then you just sit there and wait for Prajna to come into your view. And the Buddha says that Prajna comes through dhyana and samadhi. Through concentration, Prajna comes. But you can't just sit there in a concentrated state as step number one. There are things that you have to do that produce or create in you the capacity to be still and to be concentrated. And there are things that you have to do before you do the thing that creates the capacity to become still and concentrated. So today, I hope you have your pens. I'm going to give you a little bit from the Dharma of Cultivation. And the first thing I want to talk about, and this is actually part of a Vajrayana practice. And I want to explain the difference between one of the differences between Vajrayana practice and, say, maybe Theravada practice. The first thing I want to say is that Buddha wasn't a Theravadan, nor was he a Mahayanist, nor was he a Vajrayanist. You know, so these kinds of distinctions arose later as other cultural influences impacted the teachings of the Buddha. For instance, in India, begging for this person who leaves the worldly life and taking up the life of a mendicant, a wanderer, a samana, seeking the ultimate truth of life, you know, giving up wife, children, fame, money, everything. And our Theravada teachings rise with this kind of a cultural, societal, spiritual view that was in existence before the teachings of the Dhamma of the Buddha. So it's influenced by that, right? The thing about a teacher, when you're studying from a teacher, you have to recognize that a teacher has to take into consideration, you know, where he is or she is and who they're teaching, you know? And so, I mean, if they want their teachings to be understood, if they want them to be adoptable, then they have to start with where people are. They have to explain things from a certain frame of reference. So if we explain everything from an Indian or Chinese or, you know, or a Japanese frame of reference, it's just going to be like for Americans, because we have a different socialization, a different culture, a different basis for how we view the world. You know, so every teacher, I don't care whether they're teaching Dhamma, whether they're teaching math, understands that first you have to have some idea of the mindset and the view of reality of the people that they're sharing with, and try to find some way to bridge that, to tie together what they want to impart that they think is useful and will help with what their students already know. And sometimes, you know, we can know something in it and we truly know it because, and that makes it true for us. And it could be yes, that and this. And sometimes it could be yes, that at this particular time. But when you get here, you need something else. For instance, if I'm driving from First Street to Fifth Street, and I'm on Second Street, my next instruction is to go straight. But when I'm on Fourth Street, my next instruction is make a left turn at the next intersection. So it's not so much that facts change, but our situationality. Like where we are in the process changes. And with that, things change. For instance, I wrote that song, the lyrics to that song, The Dhamma Never Changes. It just asks the waves when they come crashing in your life if you're okay. And they'll say, no, you're not okay. And ask the words... ask the words you say in desperation. If they're heard, they'll say no. And then I go on and say, but did the Dhamma lose its power? When did the Dhamma fail? Never has, never will. The Dhamma stays the same. You know, so we need an anchor in life that helps us when the waves of life, the vicissitudes come crashing upon us, telling us that this is the end, everything is lost, there's no hope, there's no answer, they're out to get you. That, you know, we need to have a standard when the enemy comes in like a flood. We need to have a standard that we can raise up against it. So it's the amount of the Dhamma that's in you. You know, so it's not so much having confidence in the materiality, mentality, being, that's this mind-body being, but how much truth lies resident there, you see. How much the quality, certain qualities are there to be manifested through us, through our thoughts, our speech, and our action. So we're more like an instrument for the materialization of qualities as opposed to individual somebodies who possess something, who possess certain qualities. It's the qualities themselves manifesting through this instrument. It's more that way than the way we normally think about it. And what hinders those qualities for having expression in the world is how locked and fixed we are on ourselves and what we have and who and what we think we are. So the more we can step away from that, the more the true qualities can present and represent and recreate themselves in the world. It's kind of like we can understand it if we understand a virus, what a virus is. It's hard to understand what a virus is, too. But when COVID came out, I started investigating. I thought I knew what a virus was. I mean, I know like a germ. I know like a bacteria. No, and I mean, these are living things, these are bio things that attack other living things, other bio things, and they affect them. They feed off of them or whatever. But you know, a virus is not even a bio thing. I'm like, how can this be? You know, it's something that's not activated until it clamps on to something that is biological. And then it starts creating and replicating itself canceling out the biological thing it has attached to. And so it starts killing off that thing, that biological entity's biology. And I mean, it's a crazy thing. I mean, our science is not even up to it yet. Yet, these viruses have been here since the beginning of Jiblip, you know. So there's so much that, you know, so science is discovering some of this stuff now. And it wasn't like it just came into being because we just discovered it or recognized it. You know, it has always been. And I had not discovered the cause for that or the reason for that. And so in the last great dying off of humanity smallpox. Was it smallpox? What's the Black Death? Whatever it was. Millions and millions of people all, you know, died from it. But it's because, like, it was a germ. What's a germ? Let me see a germ. Show me a germ. And because we didn't have the science at the time to discover the reason, did not stop its properties from being in existence and having its way on us. And don't you see that ignorance is the same way as that? So it's like, I won't believe it till I see it. But if what I already believe ain't working for me, why would I be so opposed to not trying something else? Why would I so tenaciously cling to what causes me all my suffering? Because at least I can see that, and seeing is believing. And so the Buddhas and all of the great sages and the gurus, they encourage us to take this approach to life. If we're not happy with what we have, again, if we're happy with what we have, no need to seek another. Just abide in your happiness. There'll be plenty of time, you know, for you, maybe not in this life, but wherever the plantings of this life, wherever they lead for the harvest, then you can see what comes up then. And so One difference I want to make about Vajrayana practice as opposed to Theravada practice, so we can like really get rid of it. I just use those for roughly for fingerprints on the map. Like you hear, you're understanding it from this perspective, you know. Okay, it's not denigrating any perspective, just identifying the perspective. And so when the Buddha sent his disciples out and said, "Don't any of you two go in the same direction," you know. Then and he was saying like, "Go out." So actually, he really was an evangelist. He really had had what he called some good news. Okay, and he talked about how to be a recipient of that gospel, that good news. Okay, so we like to and they talk all the time about how he went about preaching, but we don't like preaching too much, so we make it teaching. And so we're like all into this teaching, you know, but sometimes teaching is like just the facts, ma'am, and it's lacking in something, you know, it's lacking by just the facts, one loses the flavor. I mean, a rose can look beautiful on a picture, but you can't smell it, you know. And now they grow roses that have no smell, no scent, and then they and some kind of way they've done, and now they just spray them to give a smell or scent. And that's an artificial one. The Buddha said that when true Dharma has gone out of the world, he said, then the counterfeit will arise and the true Dharma will be lost. And so now that we're in the Dharma ending age, we understand how this happens. It's not like the Dharma just got old and dried up and withered and died. But it's when we have less and less of a capacity to apprehend it, because teachers have less and less of a capacity to give it, and they have a less of a capacity to give it for a number of reasons. This one is just the time factor. 2,500 years of people regurgitating what somebody said, he said. You know, something. If we started in this room right here, right now, and I whispered something in Marilyn's ear, and it went to Lauren, and went to Deb, and went to Janelle. You know, by the time it got all the way to the last person, we liable to be a completely different story. Because we don't really hear things. First of all, the mind is so wonderfully made that it short circuits. So when someone is talking to you, like the mind's like, yeah, yada, yada, yada. And what it does is it skips over every few words and then it strings together what she just said. You know, and so we don't always get what was said because our mind has short, you know, taken the short version and used its own intellectual database to fill in the gaps. Did you know that about the mind? You know, it's so wonderful. That helps me to understand why the Buddha said certain things. Maybe he didn't have it from a scientific perspective, because that science wasn't available. But within the scope and the field of the Dharma, he said, we speak of him being omniscient and omnipotent, and like all powerful, because he was all knowable. But the Buddha himself said, no, I don't know everything. He said, but anything, as anything that I turn my mind to, I can penetrate it. So that's much better than knowing everything, isn't it? I mean, like, you don't have to keep all of that in your head, carting all of that knowledge around on your back. You know, you could just be free. And when you need to know something, turn your attention to it. Get still, drop out of self, and the realization rises up and it's just there, you see. So you could ask me about something, and, you know, because we have, you know, I have libraries, I have an extensive library, you know. And I do use the books a lot, but sometimes when I want to know something, I just Google, what are the five such and suches? And it'll just pop it right up for me. That's great. I don't have to memorize them now. I don't have to like go and pull out my books. I can just Google right here on my phone. I can just speak to my phone, say, "Hey, Siri." And then I ask Siri and she pulls it up. And when I read something, because of the Dharma in me, I'm like, bad translation. Or I mean, these are things you'll get to know as you know the truth and start to be the truth, start to be the Dhamma. My whole Dhammacharya program was around that, becoming the Dhamma. But the people who would enroll, they were looking for academic certificate that says, I'm like, nope, I got to see some sign. If you got it, I need to see some sign. If I don't see some sign, you don't, you, I hope you, I enjoyed the program and like go with God, Fergie. I mean, that's it. I mean, you're not going to get the endorsement because I don't see the sign. There needs to be something that's spontaneous in the person that rises it. But the Buddha said the only Dhamma that you can really teach is the Dhamma that you know, that's in you. Otherwise, it comes off as something, but it doesn't make its mark. It's like an arrow just shot out into space, and it may land and hit the person. It may land and hit the tree beside them. It may just fall to the ground. But when it's done with that, the conviction of the knowing for oneself, and he shoots the arrow, it penetrates into the heart. Maybe only if the person that it's heading toward is open and receptive. Maybe right now they're closed, and I don't mean there's anything wrong with them. It's just not right now, not this for me right now. That's it. And a lot of times, people who think, like, I'd love, excuse me for calling you out, Warren, but I love people who are like really accomplished, in science and in status and a provost of this and all of these titles, and I'll throw out something that sounds really, really woo-woo, and I'm like, this is not, they're not gonna receive this, not, and then they come back and they say, yeah, it's just like this, and they give me a scientific way for it. I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll go with that, because you understand it. But he's giving it back to me in a way that I know he absolutely penetrated the truth of it. And he could say it in scientific terms, and I say it, I use spiritual speak. And sometimes these are actually the opposites. That's why there's such an insufficiency in languaging. So if we get caught up on the language and not, the true spirit behind the language, we will miss the mark again and again and again. I'm just dropping little tips for how to walk the path this weekend. How to cultivate. And you have to look and see if there's something useful in it that you can tweak in the way that you're walking path if you're not attaining what you hoped was available through walking this path. And if you are, how to garner even more. When the Vajrayanas speak of Dharma, they're not speaking of suttas. When they're talking about suttas, they say sutras. If they're talking about doctrine, they'll say doctrine. But when we're talking about Dharma, we're talking about something that we do. We're talking about action. So dharmas are action. And when we talk about Buddha Dharma, we're talking about the actions of awakened beings. So we clear on the difference. So right now, I'm switching my hat around for a minute, and I'm talking about the Dharmas and the Buddha Dharma, the actions of awakened beings. And how they can take these actions because of the practices they do, the methods they use to allow their minds to be unimpeded, something like that. So we talk about cultivating bodhicitta and having a mind of compassion, for all beings, and we talked about compassion and power yesterday. So now we might be talking about the true power of compassion, what it brings forth, how it acts upon situations and people in the world. And when we think of that bodhicitta, the awakened mind or the awakened heart or the awakened heart mind, you know, or having that that resolved, complete mind or heart of love for all sentient beings, near and far, close in relationship and distant, human, animal, ghost, whatever. Then we start to think only awakened individuals have it. And that is in a way true. They have it in the fullness. But there is the getting of it. For instance, if I'm trying to go from here to the front door, it's not just from here, right here, where I am sitting in my bedroom, and the next step is the front door. I have to travel from here to the front door. So there, and I can't do a genie blink, at least right now, and I'm at the front door, right? Who knows, I may be at some point, but right now I can't. I have to actually put forth the effort to get up out of this chair, walk across the room, open that door, go down the hallway, go to the front door, okay? So you could think of unenlightened beings then taking up bodhicitta, and it's called causal, doing the things that will cause the mind to awaken, doing the things that will allow our liberation. So thinking in this way, there is the thought or the notion or the reality of a holy being as a bodhisattva and also us unenlightened beings as bodhisattvas in the causal phase, because we've gotten up out of the chair, but we've not yet reached the door. And some of us are still in the bedroom, not even in the hallway yet. And some of us are just a few steps from the door. And there are steps that we take. For instance, if I want to get to the door and I'm in the bedroom in the chair, the first step is to do what? I know you're thinking it. Get up out of the chair, right? I can't do step number 8, which is put my hand on the doorknob up there without doing steps number 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. I can't do number 3, which is to open the door to my bedroom without doing step number 2 and number 1. I mean, that's just common sense. And so, but somehow in around spiritual matters, we think we can like just throw stuff up against the wall and we're going to have the best possible effects. You know, we can dabble a little bit here and a little bit there. And I just want to do it in my way too. You know, my unenlightened way, this is the way I'm going to do it. But I'm expecting to yield the fruit. And so it doesn't always happen for us. So within this dharma of cultivation that allows one to move from an aspirational place to the reality of something, there are steps that we take. And the great analyzer, Shakyamuni, you know, you can buy a book of numbers. There's a book that you can order, And it's the book of ones, the book of twos, the book of threes, the book of fours, the book of fives. It goes through. So he said five, it's five of this, it's two of that, it's 16 of the other. You can just buy the book of numbers. I have it. So sometimes when I'm trying to think of what is the eight this or what is the 16 that, 16 that, I just go to the book of 16s. And then somebody's put them all together for me. How lovely. You know, so I don't have to do as much research as I needed to do. But this is the purpose of doing research, to gather the information you need to string along the bead of pearls that you're trying to string right now. It's just not for knowing the ones, the twos, the threes, the fours, you know, but they have to relate to your daily life in a certain way. And we don't learn things topically, and we don't learn things by numbers. That's not how life is lived, you know, but we are constantly encountering conditionality, dependent origination. You know, when this is, that is, when this isn't, that isn't. And so unless we are developing a capacity to see what is and understand how it came to be, we're not gonna make much progress in just knowing what is not what as much as how does this come to be? And if we don't like what has come to be, how shall I interact with the moment that doesn't make the next moment more of the same? And so this dharma of cultivation, this conduct that we do, has a step-by-step method. That's what the teachings are. They're not like just teachings. They are ideas for you to try. They are methods for you to undertake and see what happens. And you don't have to take all of them. You know, find the ones that are suitable for you, though. Find the ones that are suitable for you. And so in the dharma of cultivation, there are said to be eight fundamental right views. Now you think I'm going to be talking about the eightfold path, but I'm not. I'm now talking about how to undertake the method, to unpack and to use and to be able to clearly see the eight aspects of path. And the first one is to have a mind that truly understands impermanence. Now, if we really understood impermanence, it would be easy for us to not be attached to things. It's like we love, you know, we love that. I was watching a commercial today about, it was about a car, I forget what the car was, you know, and I just looked at that commercial, you know, and I thought, you know, why are we so enamored with some steel and gasoline and, you know, just something put together to take us from here to here? Why do we spend $50,000 and $60,000 on a car to take us from here to here, something that we're not even in that much and is designed to transport us from one place to the next? Holy mackerel, have we vectored off, you know? Or we think of, like I told you yesterday, I lived in a house and there were like four kids in one bed and there were 12 people in a two-bedroom house. And I thought, this is so wonderful. We're so all together and chummy here. And I'm so happy. You know, but by the time I got around to getting houses, you know, I'm thinking everybody needs their own bedroom. You know, everybody needs their own bedroom. You know what? I don't even want to share a bath. Everybody needs their own bedroom and bathroom. Then we came up to the age of the Mac house, you know, had these humongous mansions, you know, that we're now paying $1 million for. And then we work 12-hour-day jobs with an additional 4 hours in transportation and going back and forth, just so that we can pay for those mansions, and then we're not even happy. We fight in them every day with the people we live with that we say we love. And we put all of this time into paying for those things, you know, putting all of our effort and so very little bit of our effort in cultivating the right mind and the right heart to love our loved ones, to love our friends, and to even be able to love our enemies. And yet we say, this is who I am. I'm spiritual. This is, you know, what I care about in life. It says, yeah, you might care about it, but you don't have the skills to do it. We don't have the skills to do it because we haven't given to it the time that we gave to acquiring. And acquiring so that we could be somebody. And at the end, we wonder, what was it all for? You know? And sometimes we can recognize that we have accomplishments in life. We've done good things in life. And I'm one who believes in doing things my way. That's just how I was wired. And the more people tried to get it out of me, the more I hunkered down on, you're not going to tell me what to do, how to do, when to do, or why to do. I'm going to decide that. You know, because in my early days, people did tell me who, you know, what to do, when to do, how to do it, and why to do it. And I got tired of that. I said, that's it for that. That's all in this life. And I went 180 degrees in the other direction. But now I've been at both ends. You know, this thing about how the Dharma brings one to the middle way is so true. But it's not like a middle way on straight, flat ground. It's like one comes while they're on the path in that sutta I was reading yesterday. Which one? I think not Sutta 62. But I didn't get to 62 yesterday, did I? I'm going to get to it today. In Sutta number 8, and he was talking about what is a pleasant abiding, like when we sit in meditation, you know, and the outer world sort of drops away for a little while. He said, I don't call that practice. Now, although we call it practice, and in other places he did call it practice, but in that particular teaching, discourse, he did not call it practice. Yeah, matter of fact, he not only did not call it practice, he was clear in articulating, I do not call that practice. He said, I just call that a pleasant abiding here and now. And so we like to get in it because it does settle our mind. It does soothe our hearts. You know, it does put us in a place where we're a little bit removed from the vicissitudes of life, or from both the joys and the sorrows, so that the mind is less agitated over the joys, less agitated over the sorrows. And so we like that settling down. He said, and that's what I call that, simply a pleasant abiding here and now. He said, now here, this is what I call practice. And then he goes into all of these things, like when people are doing this, I have this mind towards. When people are shooting that arrow at me, I just put up the shield of acceptance, because this will be over in a minute. I understand impermanence. This is not going to last always. This is like a bitter pill, or this is a cruel prick in this moment. And it will only last as long as my mind is saying, this is a cruel prick. But when I can get to the place that it says, what is, you know, if that's what you think about me in your mind, what really does that have to do with me? I just need to make sure whatever it is you're saying that's so horrible is not true. Just make sure it's not true. And when one is able to do that, then these things won't trouble you so much. You won't be so concerned about, we will understand people's minds and their projections, you know. And when somebody says something, you know, like, we don't like to say, like, yeah, well, that's your perception. You know? But what if when someone said that, we could just say, honestly, John, that was not what I was thinking in my heart. And instead of trying to like throw some shade back on him, you know, like, you know, I'm really trying to understand what I said or what I did that gave you that impression about me. You know, maybe there's some way I can do something better if I don't want people to have that impression about me. Or maybe I could do something different when I'm with that person because I understand how his mind is colored or how her mind, her view is shaped. See, now this takes something because, yes, for the most part, we do know ourselves. But if we also want to be known, what are we willing to do to pull down the veil, the safety net, the shield, that which we hide behind? What are we willing to do to really be known? What are we really willing to do? Now we're getting a little bit, now that's getting a little too close to home. It's asking too much of me, you know. I mean, the key phrase that started coming across was like when, you know, where there's no sensitivity towards, and now I'm not getting political. This is just a way of life. It's where we live, right? And so I used to always tell the story of being invited to teach POC groups, and I write them back, you know, the leader of the sangha, and say, like, I'm not a Black Dhamma teacher. I'm a Dhamma teacher. When you invite me to speak to your whole sangha, call a sister up. And that was it, you know. And so I wouldn't speak in any POC groups. If I had not had given a Dhamma, you know, talk to your whole group, don't call me to talk to your POCs. Okay. And so that's, so that's just the way I approached that in all honesty and how I felt in my heart. So, you know, and then, you know, so then they said, oh, well, then will you come do our sangha? So of course I will. You know, so I was able to say what I felt needed to be said, but say it in a way without just pointing, like, look right there. You know, is that what you see? That I'm one who can talk to the Black folks? And so, so that shifted for me. So then the POCs were upset with me. They were upset with me because they thought I should use my position, you know, and my status in Buddha world, you know, to champion the Black cause. But I'm not about championing any cause except that which breaks the yoke of bondage in people's lives. That's it. And that's ignorance. And so it's and laziness. So just look, and fear and hatred, and those things don't have a color on them, you know, and just starting to work with that. And so now I no longer, need to tell that story. There's a different story that I feel is more helpful. And so I just tell whatever is good for today, you know, whatever is useful for the moment. And the climate is constantly shifting and it's constantly changing. So now we're in a space primarily due to the Me Too movement, where this has become a time for everybody to get everything off their chest, say anything they want to anybody, any kind of way. And where some people who have been historically disempowered, not just people of color, but people with certain gender orientation, or, you know, you can just come up with almost anything now, or male or female, you know, disparity in how life functions almost everywhere in this world. And so, but now's the time to, like, tell it, get it off your sleeve, call out your accusers, and, like, just, like, nail them to a cross. And so, you know, I started getting contacted to speak at all of these kinds of things. I said, like, no, you don't want me to. I'm going to tell you, because I'm not going to champion your cause. I'm going to try to speak some words that's going to, like, heal the divide. The bridge has gone up, you know, but I'm going to try to bring those two gates back down so that we can ride across on both sides of that issue. And so it says it's only one side, the side of right, you know, is what they say. And I can understand that, having always been on the side in many different areas of my life, you know, but how can I use that now? Not as a billy club, but how can I use the experience of that to help bring some understanding and to bring some healing? because that's what we said we wanted. And we said, well, what do we want? We want justice. What do we want? It right now. But actually, because of cause and condition, we can't always have exactly things the way we want them, or even the way they should be, because they didn't happen like this. They're not going to end like that. But there was a path leading to that. And there's going to be a path leading away from that. And how quickly we cover that territory depends on how we walk that path. And that's the wisdom that has to arise. Yeah. And so we should be using our dharmic platform, our awakened platform, for dropping these seeds into the ground to be cultivated. But I see in so many places, we're not doing that. You know, we're acting just like we're ordinary, untaught, run-of-the-mill people. And so we have our outrage, yes. How do I use that outrage, though, for good? First is, as long as there's still the outrage and not the understanding of the nature of the unenlightened mind, I'm not qualified. I'm not qualified to jump into the fray, because all I'm going to bring to it is my unwholesomeness. So I have to sit back and reckon with myself. I have to sit back and deal with myself. My family came from the deep south, and they were the ones who were in the field. Even my family, my siblings, they picked cotton all day. And when it wasn't cotton, they were picking tobacco. Fingers so sore at night, just bleeding from the little pricks in the cotton. And when they found out that I was moving, because I was born up north after, it's another story for another time, but my mother had been sold to a white caretaker, owner of a plantation, whose fields they gleaned. And they got together some money to get her on a bus and said, go as far as this money goes on this bus, and take your children and never come back. And never come back here. And, you know, back in those days, daughters were given over for marriage at 10 years old, 11 years old, 12 years old. Like in the South, actually, they still are. So I was born in the North, like maybe 15 years later. And when they found out that I was moving to the South, my family stopped talking to me. They were like, how could you, when you could be anywhere in the world, you know, sharing whatever that Buddha thing is that you do, you know, why would you choose to go there? I said, well, I don't know. I just have this drawing for that. I said, when it came up for me, I said, I could go to the Northeast, because that's where the money folks are. You go up there and teach Dharma in the Northeast, well, you're going to live well, you know. When you stay at their homes, you're not going to be like one place I was staying, and they had a pet rat. I don't mean mouse, I mean rat. They had a pet rat, and that rat, they even allowed that rat, and he was big too, and they allowed that rat to actually be on the table. I couldn't eat that. I went, now I talk. The first year I was just being kind. I was there. It was their pet, and I just kind of accommodated it, you know, and like, I'm not going to show my, like I'm scared of it, which I was. I put the towel under my bed at night to make sure it didn't come in my room under the door and get on my bed or something. And I was, I said, so I'm just going to, you know, I just be with this, you know, show my Dharma strength. Yeah. And I did. The next year, they invited me out, and, you know, and they put me up rather than in a hotel or somewhere, you know, someone in the congregation or the Sangha that would, you know, provide for me. It was the same household. The third year, when they invited me, the head of the center and invited me for breakfast. She has a 6-bedroom house, you know, beautiful home and lives there by herself. And she sent me a guest teacher over to stay with the people who have a rat as a pet. And so I told her how I saw it. I said, now I'm here, but I'm telling you, I'm not staying there. And I'm pretty sure I won't be coming again. And I said, because it's a wrong view. It's not a way to honor your guests. It's not a way. And it wasn't even personal to me, you know. It wasn't personal. But how could that person grow? How can that person develop? How can that, you know? And so, I mean, sometimes, you know, you can tell a person they don't have to go away mad, but they got to go away, you know. Just because there's not a meeting of the minds, even from an aspirational standpoint. Yeah. Okay. So on this, how to cultivate, and I know people are asking the question, if you don't still have a copy of the book, if you do, take it off your bookshelf and read it, because we ordered 100 books and we had, I think we had 90 people who came on all 3 days or some of those days. I mean, it was a fantastic retreat, but it's called The Dharma of Cultivation. It's a little blue book. But if you don't have it, I'll just give you the short version. So I just got a chat message from Becca. It said, hello, Venerable. I was your first private retreatant in 2016 at Heartwood. I had to leave after a few days because of asthma. I definitely had a ghost in my room. So I usually try to just let people know because our friendly ghosts will introduce themselves. And so I just thought that was funny. Okay. So I'm going to give you these, how to do the Dharma of Cultivation, like step by step, or let you know at least the 8 steps that you can take, and you can like kind of unpack that in your own way. And the first is that you have to have a mind of a mind understanding impermanence. And I was giving some examples of the things that we focus on that we know are impermanent, and yet they are more meaningful to us than the things that we say are important to us in life. And so when we have a really develop a mind of impermanence, it helps us to become to really think about and be able to come to some conclusions about what is most important to us in life. Or if you don't go from what is most important, we can look at 2 things and decide between them which is a priority, you know. And you don't leap from the you know, the bottom of the mountain to the top. You don't make it in one leap, but you make it in, you know, in incrementally. So I can look at 2 things that I do, or 2 ways that I have of being in the world, or 2, you know, and decide, and they can be diametrically opposed to each other, but both of them are in me, you know, both of them are my ways. And I can decide if they are in opposition to each other, which one really is more meaningful to me. And even if I can't make that switch, you know, we don't always look at something and decide right then, lay an axe to it. You know, you can't cut down a tree in one fell swoop, you know, but you have to be chipping away at it, cutting away. And that requires looking at something deeply. And when you do that, bit by bit, your resolve begins to line up. It shifts towards what you think is going to take you to a goal that you really want, that'll really be satisfying. Because 2 things may be opposed to each other, and both of them are satisfying to you, right? Yeah. So then you can look and say, this is satisfying to me, and it produces no later bad effects. This is satisfying to me, but it gives me troubles, you know. I mean, just being able to look at things and analyze in that way. After a while, we will come to some resolve, or we'll have some strength, I could say, to lay down something that we really want to lay down, and to take up something that we really want to take up. You know, but it takes constantly looking at it and seeing that how, because of impermanence, one can begin to even develop a, I will say, a healthy fear, if you can understand the oxymoron there, a healthy fear of impermanence. It gives you more, a greater capacity to commit, you know, because I must do this now. I can see the trajectory, the way that it's going. So I need to make this change now, this shift now. I can make this change or this shift now. And so that's the purpose of really cultivating a mind that really understands, reflects upon, and sees the danger in everything I'm saying to you is now printing on my phone. Sorry, let me figure out how to cut this off, maybe like that. Okay. And sees the danger in impermanence, and how, in a sense, I would say that impermanence is not your friend, but don't even look at it in that kind of way. It just is, right? It just is. And seeing the impermanence in everything, even the way you think in the moment, like, I'm so inspired, and tomorrow I'm gonna start doing something. Come tomorrow, like, I'm still inspired, but I'm not doing that right now. You know, it's a, I'm gonna get to it later this evening. And then it turns into 3 days, and they're like, not quite as inspired as you were before, because the action, immediate action, wasn't put into it. Or it's like, I was going to do that, but now it's 9 o'clock and I'm getting ready to go to bed, so I'll just do it in the morning. And it's like, no, tomorrow morning is not promised. This might be the last night I have to transform my mind. I'll do it. I will do that meditation tonight. I'll do that reflection tonight. You know, if I've done something or said something, you know, I'm going to make peace with myself about that tonight. You know, and so it's something like that. The second step is when one has gotten good at addressing, you know, their aspiration in the moment, there comes a mind of firm belief, because that action, as one develops understanding about impermanence, one develops a steadfastness, an ability, you know, to stay with what their intention is, you know. But it's hard to stay with an intention if you, like, poo-poo it, don't give it that much substance, you know. But once you're giving it attention, then one can begin to develop a steadfastness. And so that steadfastness then allows us to make progress on the path. Right. It's let's what's yeah, that's a good word, steadfastness. It allows us to be committed, develop more of a commitment. That's what I'm saying. Commitments can sound so absolute and so heavy-handed, so like something you gotta do. So let's not use the word commitment. Let's stay with steadfastness, because that sort of implies one wants to accomplish their goal. They want to do this. And that's how that steadfastness comes about. On that, in case the word belief is a trigger for you, a mind of firm belief, just say a steadfast mind, keeping your intention in front of you and following it up with the action. The third step is developing or cultivating a mind of renunciation. And that is simply turning the mind, turning from some things, and the mind turning towards other things. So when renounce, I remember, I think I already mentioned it yesterday, that people would ask me, how could you give up this and give up that? And I'm like, I didn't give up anything. It's like those things that were so brightly dangling, they begin to grow dim in the brightness of the Dharma that was, you know, like hitting me. That Dharma was hitting me, and it was like so bright and so rich and so hopeful and so demystifying about life has become more demystified. You know, I can hold the moment, you know, in a different way, because I have more clarity around the nature of things and even the nature of myself. And I can understand myself when I do some things and or don't do others. So I can understand others when they do some things or don't do other things. So it makes life easier and the unpleasant things more accommodatable, or you can like just go the distance. You can ride the course through them. You know, we don't have to stop and jump into every puddle. You know, we can recognize that this puddle looked just like the last one, and we can walk around it. Sometimes the puddle's so big, it's nothing to put. You got to step 1 foot in and to cross over onto the other side of the puddle. It's going to get your socks dirty and your shoes dirty, you know, okay. And maybe you'll have a chance to wash them, or maybe you just have to let it dry and then brush the dirt off when it dries. You know, you can figure out things. That's what I'm talking about. You don't feel helpless and at the mercy of who knows what. You don't feel at the mercy of anything. You just know that you're here with everything. And that changes your outlook. And it also changes your capacity, you know, to handle things. It takes away the fear of the unknown. And it also takes away the fear of the known. Sometimes we know something, you know, like to be afraid, to be very afraid of that. You know, when there is something dangerous, how does one walk through that? Knowing that the danger is there and there's no way around it. You just really have to go through that. How will we go through that? It's not just a philosophy or a doctrine that helps us, you know, with things that we could help ourselves with. But it's there designed to strengthen and encourage us when things look insurmountable. And we can know that we can also make it through this. That kind of mind of renunciation is like, that no longer has the interest or the hold on me that it did in the past. So I can spend a little bit less time with this, a little bit more time with that. And just gradually, you know, as you feel led. No, not because of the one who aroused it in you, but because of what is in you, how much of you are aroused. And just go according to your own strength, you know. So we may be telling something, but we're not telling you what you have to do. You see, that's something that you decide what you will do. That's something you decide, when to take something up, when to lay something down. And that, of course, is built on your ability, your ability to turn from things that you find less beneficial to you, and to turn towards things that you find more beneficial to you is a direct outgrowth of your steadfastness, your capacity to firmly hold on to something that you think is right and true, whether you do it or don't do it. So we start to know when I'm doing something that really goes against my own value. But, you know, when I recognize it, I'm like, oh, wait a minute, I'm better than that. Or you know, and, you know, so we have a catch-all phrase now. We just call it habitual tendency. Oh, that's my habitual tendency. Yeah. But the other part is, what could you do the next time when that habitual tendency starts to arise, right? Then what action could you take? Is like maybe about like me and the baker, thinking about something, some redeeming quality in him when I was only looking at his dark side. And while that may not have done anything for him at all, it set me free from my own arising dark side, you see? And then as one starts to develop, cultivate, act upon this mind of renunciation, actively turning, then one will take up a mind of true vows. When one makes a vow, one makes a vow to oneself. You know, the fruit of it may impact other people, you know. But when you make a vow, you know, a promise to yourself, you know, setting a standard for yourself, you're setting a standard for yourself. And when you live up to it, then you find more confidence in your ability to be true to yourself. And when you don't live up to it, then, you know, there's that prick. Oh, I said I was going to do this. I said I wasn't going to do that. I really think this is the right way to approach something. And I'm not there with it yet, but I can see the fruit and the progress that I'm making, you know, because I'm willing to look at it, you know. And so giving yourself some credit for the good, you know, we're always looking at what we don't do. And that was that's a form of teaching that the Buddha utilized to help us to really look at what we're not doing. But he also said that we should consider the things that we do good, that we do correct. Now, that's a stage of it. You can consider those things so they won't think like I'm such a miserable failure, so that you won't get into the flagellation bag. You know, because you fall into that one, like, just no way to get out. If you're whooping yourself, ain't nothing nobody can do to help you, you know. So it keeps us from not flagellating ourselves, you know. And, but it also, when we look at the things that we do that are beneficial and that are kind and that are good, it helps us to have confidence in ourselves, our ability to not only walk the path, but yes, our ability to walk the path, but also to complete the path. You know, you'd hate to be like on a treadmill. You just walking, doing good walking, but you're never going to get to the goal. Yeah. So it gives us some encouragement that I can reach the goal. Not that there is a goal, but I'll never reach it, but that I can reach the goal. Even if I don't reach it, ultimately, you know, in this life, still, I have confidence that I'm not where I was. I'm not who I was. I'm not what I was. And that has its own value to you. That is based on a healthy self-esteem rather than an esteem that's needed to feel like somebody. You see? When one takes up this mind of true vows, you know, it's the cause of action, because we act out of the vow we take when we feel like it and when we don't. We just reflect back to the vow that I made to myself. And is this a situation where I need to really be able to apply that? Yes, it is. And how do you feel about that part? Well, I'm not feeling too good about it at all. Nevertheless, because I recognize, you know, that I need to grow and develop in that. And it's going to be a little uncomfortable, you know, making that next step, changing my position, choosing in this moment to love a person I feel like hating, choosing in this moment to accept a person that is really not acceptable to me, choosing in this moment, you know, to understand that the person is not the culprit, that the ignorance is, choosing to accept in this moment that I personally don't have the skillfulness to help him turn from his way or from her view. Choosing to understand the inadequacy of both of us in this present moment. And recognizing that I am choosing. And it didn't just happen. We can't use habitual tendency as a scapegoat. We have to also recognize that we are deliberately and emphatically choosing an action that we take at this moment. And there come a place in that when you didn't have the strength to go against your own choice, maybe you didn't even see it as a choice. After a while, you'll start to see it as a choice and that I'm really choosing. It didn't like get ahead of me and popped out of my mouth. We like slow down that time frame because that's what wisdom does. You know, it like just brings you to a now moment. And you can start to see, like, I did think about it briefly and jumped right in, you know. That why I said, like, that just happened and it popped out of my mouth. Nope, I can see more clearly now, you know, that nanosecond that thought arose, that it shifted from being okay to not okay. It shifted from what? I know she didn't just say that. You know, you can, that took me about 4 seconds to say, but the mind thinks like a computer and it's right there, that what in the mind. I know she didn't just say that. And then I jump in with my retort. It seems almost like it's no time. And that's why sometimes as we're meditating, especially doing Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, we start to see the elongation of a moment. A moment is not a moment. The word moment is just a word. You know, but there is like this time gap, and time is malleable. It can expand out. I remember I had an accident one time, and I'm going to tell you, the minute I recognized that I was not going to be able to stop on that ice going down a hill, and I knew that there was going to be an accident, an impact, I was going to hit something. I mean, time slowed down and I saw it in slow motion. I mean, you know, like it just went from straight up regular time to like it just slowed down at every second was like a minute. You know, I was like, will this accident ever occur? You know, because the thing was going so slow, in such slow motion for me. I'm sure you've had moments like that. I mean, I had that today with losing track of the time just in preparing myself for a meeting with you this morning. You know, so that's the way I do when I'm planning to meet with someone or planning to share the Dharma with someone. I'm not thinking so much of what I want to say to you. I'm thinking about how to put myself in the right position to receive the flow of prajna and to activate enough compassion to allow prajna to have its way with me, its first place in my life during this time with this encounter. And in that way, things that I don't know need to be said, you know, that I have no way of knowing that something that's in somebody's mind or whatever, you know, it just comes forward. And that was what somebody needed to hear. Just that one little thing, that one little kernel or whatever. And so it's not like I really prepare around a thing, but I prepare myself to be able to be in the moment and to receive. And when you develop along those lines, you won't have a lot of anxiety about things. When she called me and said, you're 15 minutes late. I'm like, what? You know, and I said, I'll be on in a minute. And because I've been ready, you know, for hours just waiting for this time. And I jumped right on. Without I can be blamed because, you know, last time I looked, I still had an hour and 15 minutes. You know, it's like, oh, good. You know, I did check a few times. But, you know, so I apologize for not being right there with it. But by the same token, I don't have a sense of shame or blame around it. It's just what happened. And I stepped up my game and got on here really quickly. And that's how it is. So that's how you can make a misstep or something happens, and you don't have to make such a big deal about yourself about it. You know, just correct and keep going. That's it. I'm wondering what people think about you. You just need to know what you think about you. Now that you really do. You have to know. And a lot of times you putting on other folks things that's not even in their mind. You know, you looking at somebody and there's a scowl on their face and you think that's because you crossed their path and they don't even recognize that you crossed their path because they're not even thinking about you. Their mind is in the past about something. Or mind is in the future about something, you know, and they didn't even see you. And yet you passed them by thinking, oh, they didn't like me. That's because we are so in the center of a world that we create around ourselves and project on. So this mind of renunciation allows us then to be more discriminating around what we see and hear and taste and touch and smell and think. A lot of times when we're thinking thoughts that we know we shouldn't think, we just want to think them for a minute, you know, just a little bit. You know, and then like, I'm not going to go too far into this because I know this is not even a good direction to go. But, you know, she did say such and such, or she did do such. Or I think this is what she was thinking, you know, and that's like kind of how we are. And so we indulge ourselves in certain ways. But as this heart of renunciation starts to develop in us through action, through taking specific actions around things in our life, we're not all over in somebody else's life, we're just in our life. When that starts to happen, then we can more quickly shift our mind, and we can more surely stay on the path. And after a while, it'll be like you trying to step off for a minute, you know, because you're trying to get your outrage going. And it's like you and the path have two pieces of Velcro stuck together. You're trying to take your foot over there to think that thought for a minute, and you can't quite lift your foot. So you're no longer good at being bad. You know, it's like, oh, look at this. You know, it's I try to be bad about something, and it becomes difficult. It becomes as uncomfortable for me as, you know, doing that or thinking that dastardly thing was comfortable for me at one time. And that's when you can feel really good instead of feeling bad, like I'm never going to get it. I'm never going to be perfect. This is not about thinking in those terms. You know, but you start to really appreciate yourself. You start to really appreciate the walk that you walk in your life. You start to really appreciate the Dharma, you know, and you start to see how honest the Dharma is with you. And how you were like reading something into it and you wanted it to say something that validated you and before, you know, and now it's like, oh, Panyawati needs no validation. You know, it's like, oh, I don't need it to prop me up and shore me up. I want to be it. I want to live the truth. I want to be the truth. And in the beginning, this is very meager, you know, so understand that it's meager. Don't think you can leap over the moon. You know, your Nikes are not going to give you that same lift that they give Michael Jordan. You know, you, but if it lifts me just a little ways, how beautiful. I was looking at one of the residents at Heartwood, and he was giving up his dance career because he said he just saw so much and he just got so disgusted by it. And he's a choreographer to the stars. And, you know, I never really, you know, like when people apply to come there and stay for a while, I have this really long application, but I never really read all of it. So I just read it really quickly, and I know it has taken them hours to do it. But the reason I did it is because I wanted them to reflect on who they think they are and what they think they've done or haven't done or have or has had. I'm not really concerned about their business and all of that stuff. You know, I just want to make sure they are not a mass murderer, that they, you know, some things that put other people at risk for with them being there. And something that indicates to me, because I know it's going to take something there when you're living with people that wasn't by agreement, I know it's going to take something. And to try to ascertain whether I think they have the capacity to get something from being there, and also to not tear down what is there. You know, that's sort of my role with that. But you know, so I like breeze through it really quick and look and see if anything jumps out at me. Otherwise, the rest of it is just a story. And everybody's got a story. I even got my own, you know, so I'm not going into that too much. But I want to see what they're able to acknowledge, what they're able to articulate. And it gives me some idea of how they think about themselves. And so, so I got his thing, and he's like, I'm giving up choreography and dance. And all the teachers he studied with in that, you know, like, I don't know them because I'm not into dance anyway. So they're just names on a paper and all of that. And so he's been there for a year now, a year and a month. He was coming for a 1-year residency. And he had to think about what he'd do with his life now that he's given up everything that he's trained for. You know, and but he sings, he's got a golden voice. That's the lead singer you hear on some of the songs. And I don't know why this technology messes up. Somehow, when you send a tape or when it sounds perfect in the studio, but if we send it to somebody, there's some kind of garbling or something that happens sometimes. It doesn't happen on everybody's, but I noticed it distinctly on ours playing yesterday. I'll find some way to get it where you can download it and then hear it. But he has a beautiful voice. He has a unique voice, one that just pierces your armor, you know. And I told him, I said, singing is for you. He said, well, I haven't trained in that. I said, all the more better. This is something that's naturally arising in you, you know. And this is, he said, but I never sang before I came here. I said, this is the power of your cultivation. Can't you see that? This is your vidya rising. This is a out-picturing of the dharmic wisdom that's in you that gives you something that you offer people that, you know, that is beautiful and touching, and you're not all wrapped up in it. Like, look at me. Yeah. And so, and then I just sat there the other night and I Googled his name. You know, like if you're important, somebody should just be able to Google your name and find you, right? So I just Googled his name. I said, thinking in my own mind, not that much is going to come up, right? And I Googled his name and like all of this stuff More than what I have. All of this stuff is like just downloading. He's been the choreographer for Beyonce, and he's been the choreographer for some. And this person, I said, "Holy smokes! I have a true celebrity in my presence." And what do I have him doing? I have him working in the store. I have him hoeing the vegetable garden. I have, and so I said, so now it's time to take him back to these gifts that he has for the world, and to use it. All of us can't be monks, okay? And 6 months ago, he took temporary vows. I'm thinking, okay, it's time for him to give them up and get back to work at what he's excellent at. He has something to offer the world. So I say that for you. Sometimes we embark upon this, like this becomes, our vocation and our avocation, but we have a place in the world. We have things that we have to do, things that ways that we can contribute. So while we're getting ourselves together, it doesn't mean that we give up that which is beneficial, and I said we offer to the world for their healing. The bridges, like the capacity for explaining things. Do you have that vision and logic? Do you have I can say about Warren that he has it because and he needs to go forth with that. Now that he's retired and he doesn't have to toe the line of what he can only say as a university provost and professor and so forth, now he can just speak as Warren. And he can talk to him, but he has a capacity to explain deep and complex scientific stuff to people like me who like are dullards in understanding that stuff, And so he should use that to help people have more understanding, It's and so it's so we find ways then of taking either our acquired gifts or what in naturally starts to arise in us as we deepen our spiritual practice. We become an offering to the world. So when I was singing the song yesterday, I surrender all to you, everything I give to you, withholding nothing. That's the kind of mindset we develop. Instead of, I am smart, I am gifted, I know how to do this, it's I surrender all, everything I have to you, withholding nothing. I lay it all down. I lay it all down. I lay it all down in service. I lay down my foolish pride and all the hurt I feel inside. My future and my past are the worthless things that will not last. I lay it down, holding back nothing. I lay it down in service. I also lay it down in worship, not just like a worship, like here, this pipe running this way, but in this, I ascribe worth to you. That's why I offer my best, because you're worthy. And when we develop that view and that heart towards people, then we find our own inner freedom. And we become useful to the world without anxiety, without fear, without ego, without pride, without arrogance, without confusion, without wondering constantly, am I making the right move? Should I do this? Should I do that? We won't cling to things. Before a person comes, like they come and handing me something in one hand, and I'm handing it to somebody else with the other. That goes for money. That goes for praise. That goes for anything. As soon as it's being handed to me, know, and if I need some of it, I take the little bit I need and pass the rest on. Support somebody else's ministry. And that's how we become free. We're withholding nothing, and we're holding on to nothing. You see, that's something that's in your heart. That's why this is not, I say again and again, an intellectual kind of thing, no, but it becomes the totality of your being. The whole you, the full you that has as a seed, you know, that that Dharmakaya body, that true suchness, that deep emptiness. You don't even know. I don't even know what I'm capable of, what I can offer, what can pass to me. I don't know. But I can stand ready and open. You know, eyes wide open when I see something coming, when I evaluate the impact. And there may be other things that I wanted to do, but like, I'm just not good at it. Like, give that up and do what you're good at, that you can help somebody. And yes, you might have to do some more studying. You might have to do some learning. You might have to, you know, give up something else to be able to do that. But that's where you like can weigh. You don't have to be confused. You can weigh things. And you're not forced to do anything. You recognize that you're always deciding. Always deciding. So, this mind was on for the mind with true vows that are the causes of action. Yeah. So, the fifth, then, is the mind of diligence. The mind of true vows, the causes of action, leads one to the culmination of a mind of diligence. And that's the mind of diligence is the mind that is continually advancing, but with the right kind of efforting, not through pushing or forcing, but through clear seeing and allowing. That kind of efforting. The effort to see clearly and the effort to allow what is developing as a result of your cultivation to come to fruition. Ooh, this is so much easier, isn't it? If one could look at things this way. And when one understands diligence in this way, you know, this kind of advancement that is of its own accord. I'm not forcing something or enforcing anything, you know, then you can lead without being an arrogant ruler. You know, you can get things accomplished without demanding that people do things. You can see quickly if there's no way to do something because you're not surrounded by the right people and it takes more than you to just do it. You don't consider not doing it a defeat. You just recognize that the timing and the conditions are not right. And even though you may want to do it now, the time and the conditions are not right. I have a Dharmacharya program. I have a monastery. I have a retreat center. I have a local sangha. I have ministries that I do in the world. But 20 years ago, I encountered a teacher that I felt an immediate affinity for the way that he taught the Buddha's Dharma. But I didn't want to do the things that he suggested I do. So I had enough sense to realize, like, don't play with fire because you might get burned. So I would just stay on the periphery. You know, like, there's lots of rooms in a house. Why you got to hang out in the furnace room? So I stay not too close to him, just close enough to get the teachings and close enough for my teacher to be able, because she's all in, hook, line, and sinker, for her to get all the good stuff and for her to call and to share it with me and allow me every once in a while, like once a year, maybe to be in one of his Dharma assemblies so that I can like just gently and gradually create some affinity between us. But I don't want to do too much. I didn't want to be seen either because I knew I wasn't going to be right. I wasn't like that committed to something. But now, you know, 20 years later, almost 16 years, I am ready. I'm ready. I am so ready, you know, that it means that all of these things that I have built are like nothing to me. And I'm in the process of laying them all down because I have found something for me to do that is more excellent. I've found teachings that have been expressed to me in a way that I could grow so much more excellent than the way that I teach. I've found, you know, and so I'm divesting and to fully enter into that. And it requires me giving up everything that says who I am. I was telling, I think I told Marilyn, you know, that this is probably the last retreat that I do. Just in terms of going out and doing retreats at, you know, with other sanghas. And it could be a scary place if I hadn't cultivated a mind understanding impermanence and a mind of established a mind of firm belief and developed a mind of renunciation and set upon true vows, realizing true vows that are the causes of being able to take actions for the benefit of others, even if I must decrease. It was like John the Baptist, and he was preaching about the one to come, and he told everybody Jesus was the one, and then he thought Jesus was going to revolutionize, pull out his whip, and make everybody get in line, and instead, he's letting them, you know, abuse him, talk about him, and all these things. He sent a message, you know, John the Baptist was in prison by that time, but he sent a message. He said, are you the one, or should we look for another? And Jesus sent a message back to him. All he said is the lame walk and the blind see. He said, believe my words, or at least disbelieve them for the very work's sake. And then John the Baptist said, I must decrease. So sometimes you encounter this in your life, but fear will make you hold back and not step into it, you know. But if you have been developing, and I, you know, Buddha Master gave me a discourse to read. Before I can share them, they have to become real for me, have to be a reality for me. So I was just reading one of them, and it just shook me to my very core. Very simple. You know, it's just a very simple teaching. It's one of those, I already know that kind of teaching, you know, but just the particular way that it impacted me, you know, just changed, like sitting in that optometrist's office and you can't see, and he clicks some glasses and he says, how's that? And you're like, oh, this is real good. I can see perfectly now. He said, you think that's perfect? How about this? Click. And he clicks one more time and like, whoa, you know, like you see so clearly. And you thought the last time was it, you know? So we'll go through these times like, oh, got it now. No, I got this down. I understand. And then something comes and it completely recalibrates your capacity to see. and understand. That's an in here liberation. You know, that's inside of you. And then you can walk in the world a different way. But the revelation occurred inside. So when this happens, this diligence that allows you to make persistent progress, persistent advances, persistent clarity, becoming more and more clear, and becoming magnanimous. That's what we call equanimity. Equanimity is not just like just resting in this place of non-attachment. It is like being fully infused and experiencing everything that everybody's feeling, their joys, their sorrows, their suffering, their good fortune, all of it. And yet so boundless in your openness to them. So boundless, you're having boundless generosity towards others. And so instead of using the word that's translated equanimity, we think of it as boundless generosity. If you can imagine a vast ocean with 100-foot waves, it's almost scary to you. Like if you could imagine 100-foot wave coming over you, about to like completely cover you, but it's 100-foot wave of generosity and love. You can't stop a wave like that. You can't stop it. You know, and that's what happens in your life. And that's what uproots that self you were trying to get rid of. You were trying to uproot. You were trying to lay the axe to, you know, that wave just carries you. And by the time it finishes rolling out, that wave is so far away from where you can visually see it. So far away. The self can't even get back in again. And now that's my imagery for myself. You know, like for what I feel occurring and been occurring over the last 15 years in me. What's been occurring for you? You have to know. You have to know yourself. The sixth Zen patriarch said, you know, to know the Dharma is to know yourself. And to know yourself is to know the 10,000 things. And so with this mind of diligent, taking persistent, making a persistent advance, one develops a mind of truly understanding and walking in the precepts and the vows as your standard of conduct and as how we seize the essence of our life. And when one has that mind of appreciation for precepts and vows, then one can easily enter into meditative attainment, dhyana, samadhi, with right mindfulness. You know, mindfulness, if he calls it right mindfulness, there can be wrong mindfulness. So we can develop great mindfulness, but what are we mindful of? You know, so in learning the components and the way of mindfulness in the Dharma, it's always attached to something. Mindfulness of something. What are we mindful of? Otherwise, we can become very discerning, very sharp, very acute, very our capacity for critical analysis can become very great. But did it unlock your heart? Did it make you a fully human being? And did it take you then out of the lineage of an ordinary being into the lineage of awakened ones? And so that's where meditative attainment is real attainment. You know, we have to reach up to the bar. We can't like just keep lowering the bar to our standard. After all, we'll just be doing chin-ups and talking about how much progress we make it because we've lowered the bar. You know, we got to leave the bar up there and just keep trying until we can you know, ascend to it. Even if you can get to place, you can only put your finger over the bar in the beginning and the tippy toe, and you know, this way with one hand on the bar. And after a while, you can stretch ourselves to two hands. Then we try to pick ourselves up, feet don't come off the floor. And then we keep trying, and we lift ourselves up a little bit, and we keep going until we can get up there, and we can truly do those chin ups instead of lowering the bar and just doing like this. And so even when we look at the Ennobling Eightfold Path and we see where meditation comes in, where we see where concentration comes in, we see where mindfulness comes in. You know, all those other things came first. All of those other things came. But we, you know how we are, we like want to jump right into meditation and we want to like do our thing, and we make some progress. We make some progress, though, at our level. Is that enough? And then, so that's the seventh mind, a mind that rests, can truly rest, because on the pillow, because off the pillow, one is working. And then the eighth view or step is that of a mind of bodhicitta, and that creates so the seventh step to that meditation, that's what unlocks, you know, it's the cause of wisdom. Prajna is found in that seventh step. And that's why meditation can be of such a benefit, you know, in fostering clarity and allowing the change if we're doing all of these other things. Well, sometimes we just have a meditation that's just good for me because I get at peace for a minute there. But okay, so it's good for you then because I'm not throwing all my trash on you too. You know, so in that way, but it's not the best, the highest and the best. I'm trying to show you, like, when we put together the full counsel of the Dhamma, so that we have a full picture, not a, I don't know, what do you call it, 2D, like it's written on a piece of paper, but like a 3D, even 4D, fourth dimensional, 5D. Experience of the power of the Dhamma. And the eighth mind is the bodhicitta that causes us to become bodhisattva, sattva being a being, one who possesses, right? Citta being mind, one who possesses this kind of mind. Bodhi, awakening. So as long as we're on this path, we are bodhisattvas at the causal stage. Now, if one thinks that that's not really true, we can go back to Sutta number 128. I don't have to open it. I can remember that little line, but it says the Buddha asked them when they were meditating. First, he asked how they were getting along. He said, we're blending like milk and water. He said, good, good. How do you do this? So there was the first requirement. It was a walking out of something, right? Walking out of relationships, blending like milk and water. These people who were put together, not by choice, but by aspiration, they came together. Blending like milk and water. And he says, good, good. And how do you do that? He says, I set aside what I want to do, and I do what they want to do. And I find that the less I think about myself, the more I'm present for others. the more I'm able to do things. It's not rocket science. And so he said, and good, and good. And how is your meditation practice? He said, oh, we abide diligent, ardent, and resolute. He said, well, that's great. He said, well, have you had any super normal experiences since you've been meditating? They said, yeah. And then they began to tell about this. They would see visions and light and form, and they'd get, you know, some of the, you know, we have more capacities and faculties than we think we have. Some of them are just not awake in us due to the delusional nature of the mind, just due to our hindrances, you know, that keep us from sharpening and using all of our faculties. And so he, in that sutta 128, the Buddha talks about the six supernormal powers. He didn't say they're supernatural in the ways that we think of, ooh, but he said supernormal, heightened, more, you know, even a person who is blind, when he loses eyesight, then she develops more of a capacity to be able to detect something or know something through another sense. You see, another, it could be a hearing becomes more acute, or it could be, you know, this is just how, just in a normal, you know, person, we can see how that combined, these sense gates and the combined with the consciousness of the brain computer. And we just think it's these six gates and it's the brain, you know. But actually, there's more impulses going from the heart to the brain than from the brain to the heart and the other parts of the bodies. Did you know that? So I'm glad the scientists have figured it out, because maybe now we can take up a science of consciousness, and that heartfulness and love will start to become the supreme ultimate instead of poo-pooing that. That's why when we talk about the age of the feminine, that's what, you know, comes to my mind more than feminine power. It's the qualities that we recognize, the qualities of softness, the qualities, you know, that maybe because we were relegated to second class, we had to find unusual means to make it in the world, you know, but by whatever means. Many of us have cultivated special qualities that don't involve force, that don't involve demand, and that give us because we weren't that strong, we couldn't rely on our strength. We had to rely on something else, you know, and so we've learned how to do that and still be here, you know, and so. So it's kind of in this way, he said, there are these skills and there are these abilities that can be established and developed in us. And he talked about the power of divine vision. And like we have a vision, and if our vision starts to get bad, like I think they used to say, I don't know, 2020 is like perfect vision, you know, but if I don't know exactly what 2020 means, but I know that at one time I was 2050, 2070, and I could hardly see back then because of glaucoma from diabetes. And so it must mean that it either means that 70 feet, I can only see what a person sees at 20 feet or at 20 feet, it's like I'm 70 feet away or something. I know it's a bad number when that second number is high. That's what I know. And but this is like this when, like, maybe it was you become 20/10 or 25, you know, like you have a capacity to see far, far. I had a master and she had done the Dharma. She had done a Dhammo Dharma. And what arose in her was the ability to hear 1,000 miles. Now, we can like to say, I don't believe that, and that's okay. But this is what I can tell you that I know. I don't know how many miles away she could hear, but I know that I didn't talk about her till I got beyond 1,000 miles, because I would go places and, you know, I'd sneak out the monastery because I felt she was so tough and I felt she was so hard, and I felt she was really hard on me, more so than other people who were there at the monastery. And she would even let them go off the grounds. I couldn't leave the grounds. I'd go out in the back, and there was a loose plank. I didn't loosen it. It was just already loose. And I would slip through that plank, and I would go and meet them at Starbucks, you know? And when I'd come back, she'd say to me, she'd just come, just to let me know. She said, "You have such a dirty mind." And she'd tell me all the things I said about her, you know? And I'm like, oh, maybe she does have ears to hear 1,000 miles. Okay, so there was this time, you know, and when I first got there, I love peanut butter. I used to love peanut butter. And when we first got there, all we had was Chinese food, everyday noodles. For a treat, we had rice, you know, so it was like noodles all the time. And some Chinese herbs in them. I come to love it now, but back then, like, America. We're in America. Can we ever have any American food, you know? And so a lot of times I was like disrespectful in that way. You know, I really wanted to be there. I really wanted to know. Didn't want to go anywhere. But yet I was complaining about everything. Just not having the right attitude. You understand what I'm saying? You know, wanting something and then wanting somebody to give it to you in your way. It's like that. Just not having enough respect for that, what you want. How much of it can you get then? How much affinity will be there? How much will translate? How much rides on the wind or on the wave of your attitude and respect for the very thing that you say you want? You just don't want it to look like that. You don't want it to come in that way, you know? And those are the things we have to reckon with ourselves. Like, sometimes the information is coming and it ain't coming from who we want it to come from, you know? So what do? We either accept or reject. But even when we accept, we accept without an appreciation and respect for the giver of it, then it becomes tainted and we can't come into the fullness of it. And so so I was just thinking about peanut butter. I said, "You ain't got no peanut butter in this place, you know?" And she goes by me in her usual whirlwind huff, and she goes out the door. She comes back in, bam, and slams this big old jar of peanut butter on the table. And they said, "Now, will you get back to work?" You know, so those are the things that I learned about there really being things that I didn't know. Of course, that was over 20 years ago, 20, 25 years ago. So I encountered many things early on that I actually don't see so much now, you know. But I know that they are there. And that some things are resident in others and even in myself from what I experienced 25 years ago that never became standard, ordinary, and common because of the disrespect, the lack of respect I afforded it. You know, when it came, but yet I know that it's there and that it's true. So when I read these things, I don't think that this is mistranslation or this stuff ain't real. Because I've had the direct experience even before I understood the teaching around it, even before I encountered, you know, the teaching. So he talks about our divine vision, the power of knowing the past and the future. That was the lion's roar. If we ain't going to take that in, then what are we doing? The Buddha himself began to talk about how on that night of his awakening, how he went back to one life, two lives, three lives, five lives, 10 lives, 20 lives. He went back to Buddha saying, "Oh, you know, like, I like this mindfulness stuff, but the rest of that, not so much. You know, that doesn't, like, just doesn't accord with what I already know, what I believe, but I don't call it a belief, though. I just call it pragmatism." You know? And so he talks about the power of knowing the past and future. He talks about divine hearing, talks about the power of reading minds. And reading minds doesn't mean like looking into Ron's mind, like, "Oh, I see what's in Ron's mind," you know, but it's like being present with the thoughts that are circulating, that one knows how to, like, help untie knots, knowing what to bring forth, knowing what the temperature is in the room, knowing how it's so much more than just those two words, reads minds. You know, but we have to have that kind of boundless generosity that puts us in that spatial place where we can see all of these things. If everything is right close here, it's not much space between my hand and my face. But when it's held out there, there's a lot of space. There's a lot of capacity to know something. And the power of divine travel, and that has to do with that collapsing of time thing, and we're not even going to talk about that today. And then the extinction of the knots of samsara, conditional or rebirth linking consciousness. So if we view everything just from our appearance, not considering there had to be something that produced an appearance, and it certainly had to be something more than physical, more than just an egg and a sperm coming together, you know. But there's in the Buddhist dispensation, the teaching of the rebirth linking consciousness. Mm-hmm. So that all of this, including consciousness, maybe it doesn't come from physical. So our physical sciences have not caught up to something yet. Or in some places they have. You know, but maybe the consciousness comes first and creates this being when combined with the right conditions of sperm and egg that can produce a form. Oh, but that's another whole retreat, right? Okay. We won't go there today. But I say this, like this eighth step about bodhicitta, because I want us to know that even in our unenlightened state, you know, bodhicitta can be in its causal trajectory. So an unenlightened being can be a bodhisattva too. The Buddha said it in Sutta 128 and many other places, but I like that one because he lays a foundation for how to get there. You know, he said, while I was yet an unenlightened bodhisattva, I had these experiences, but then they fall away. And I wonder, what is the cause for that? And then I analyze. And I realized and I put something into action until I came up to the fullness of the measure of the stature of an awakened one. Now, when I think back to 1985, when I gave up my church because I had a conversation with the one in whom I believe. And I said, I believe that you are not the only one. If you were, what would be the point for me? I just have to be groveling looking for your favor. I said, but I believe that I can come up to the fullness of the measure of the stature, of your stature. But some information is missing. I said, where's the information? I have a book here that's got 66 chapters. I know the Vatican has probably 20,000 manuscripts. I already know I'm missing some stuff, you know? And this was the conversation I had with Jesus and Holy Spirit. Look, we got to have a powwow, you know? And that was it. And that voice spoke to me. And I also saw something that I'm just now stepping into. And that voice said, you have not seen the pattern. So I said, well, I need to see the pattern. and said, you're not going to be able to see it where you are. You're going to have to step out. Now, not everybody has to step out. You know, awakened ones are not only Buddhists, you know. And so, but for me, because I was so entrenched in the institution of it, that it would be a hindrance for me, that I needed to step out. He said, and that inner voice said, if you want to know what a master means, don't ask his disciples. They're trying to figure it out. Go ask another master. So I set out looking for the wisdom of master of another, like, religion, spiritual tradition. And I kept hitting glass ceiling, every one, until I discovered the Dharma. And I'm still here, uncovering, discovering profound truths, because I'm searching for them. And as that's my journey. See, we each have a journey. You have to know your journey. And if you're dilly-dallying at the rest stop, or if you've reached as far as you want to go, you know, you may think you want to go to California, and when you're going across country and you stop by Arizona and like, whoa, this is really nice. And like, you're like, just forego California. Arizona is the place to be. But I didn't know there was an Arizona until I was traveling and happened to hit Arizona. I thought I wanted California. That was just an idea in my mind. But now that I've discovered Arizona, Arizona is the place to be for me. So you can choose your seat and sit down. But don't let anybody else choose your destination for you. And when I'm teaching, I know when I'm coming to the end of what's for me to deliver, when my conversation shifts in these ways. No longer sharing instructions, but encouraging and inspiring in the way that I was encouraged and inspired, and not by anybody from the outside. I didn't go and sit down and have a talk with my pastor. You know, yes, I was a pastor, but you know, you never leave your head. So I still had a pastor. But I couldn't sit down and talk to them. I was at a crisis in my life around my place and the meaning of life for me. And I had to have that inner conversation. And people thought, oh, she's leaving God. She's leaving, you know, when I left the church. I said, no, I'm just leaving the church, you know. I said, and I can't take you with me. That was on a Saturday. Sunday, that's how quick I moved. Sunday, I took my congregation to a friend's church. And I left them there. I said, I can't take you with me because I don't know where I'm going. But the one in whom I believe told me to go in this direction. And that's it. That's what I did. Now, stepping out of some of the things I'm doing, I'm all engaged now. Maybe it's because of my age. I'm 71. You know, so I'm a little slower than I was when I was, you know, in my late 20s and in my early 30s. I could, like, just jump out. Then I could, because, like, I'm strong. I got physical strength, even. I have more mental strength, even. And then, and I had more, what do you call it when you're, when you're a child and, you know, like, more naive. You know, I didn't, couldn't think of enough things, you know, to count up the cost. It's like, oh, no, I'll just go in this direction. If that don't work, I can go in that direction. But when you're 71, you start thinking, like, you might only have enough strength to go in one direction, you know, so you need to make your call in an election, sure. And that's how I, you know, I know where I am. I know where I am in my lifetime and embarking upon a new journey and a new project at 71 is not that easy, except if you have no other choice. And I have no other choice. And so I'd like to open up the floor now. And we are for sharing. You can ask questions. You can share your heart with the rest of the Sangha and just see where we go over this next hour or close to an hour. And we will end. It's like turning on the pressure on the water, and the water comes out the holes. And when it finishes, you can't get any more water out. So I hope that this retreat has been beneficial to you. And I'd like for you to also share. Remember, the Buddha said, when I was an unenlightened bodhisattva. So he was sharing in his unenlightened state. So we have to be able to receive from each other. Can't look at somebody and say, oh, they not enlightened. You know, I know more than they know. But we have to be humble and willing to hear from other people, willing to respect other people's journey as just as valid as our own journey. And in that way, we will learn something more than just what we can understand. You know, I don't have to stick my hand in the fire to know that it burns. I can just watch somebody else put their hand in it and their skin start melting. I don't have to do it. You know, so we can learn from each other, you know, if we can respect each other and respect each other's journey. And sometimes sounds so simple. You know, it's like, who didn't know that? But yet you find yourself caught in a circumstance. And this little simple thing is your way of escape. You can think, oh, I don't do any of the big sins. I don't do, you know, like I don't commit adultery. I don't kill anybody. I don't steal. I don't, you know, it's just, we can think I'm okay. But it's the little foxes that spoil a vine. It's the little ones. And then we'll close out with a song. And I hope it plays okay. I don't know. If you think, let me see, I can't play it from my phone because I have my rehearsal one on my phone. So we'll play it anyway. And Okay. I hear myself reverb. I'm doing something wrong. Oh, okay. this is a song. It's I didn't write the melody or create the music. I just rewrote the lyrics. And it's the lyrics that are important. I'm trying to write the owner of the song because it's not 20 years old, so it's not in public domain. But the words, I'm going to give you the words in case you don't hear can't make out the words to the song. And it says, tell me the truth, I want to know. Just how to look and where to go. I need to find true peace. I need to understand, to bring my suffering to an end. Release the love I hold inside. Let me be true and never hide behind a face of fear or animosity. I must let go. I will be free. The time is now. It's destiny. Surrender now that I have found a way to keep somehow more than a broken vow. Let me always forever be on one accord, truth in me. abiding in sweet grace, the glow upon my face, victorious until I win the race. I must let go. I will be free. The time is now. It's destiny. Surrender now that I found a way to keep somehow more than a broken vow. The noble path. I walk it every day, and yet I realize there's more to life than only misery and lies. I close my eyes. I found the way, the course that leads to ease, a liberating path that frees. I can let go. I can be free. The time is now. It's victory. Surrender now that I have found a way to keep somehow more than a broken vow. Life is impermanent. But true Dharma is available right now. Don't squander your life. Now, that's the words of the words of the song. But when we put it together with the music, it was the perfect song and from a secular song. And that's why I'm saying let's get rid of these notions around this is secular and this is spiritual. You know, don't think so much in those terms. We don't have to draw a line in the sand, you know, and say I'm on the spiritual side, I'm on the secular side. It's a false demarcation. And when it's set up in that way, actually it hinders. It doesn't help. So let us go forth in charity towards people and charity, love. It suffers long, long suffering, kind, not envious, not proud, but gives us the capacity to endure all things to the end.